Welcome back on this Monday, the 15th day of April, 2024. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And I guess, folks, we need to start off with the big news from over the weekend. As promised, and to absolutely no one's surprise, Iran finally retaliated against Israel for the strike on their sovereign embassy territory last week, launching a barrage of drones and missiles against military targets in Israel Saturday night. And here's where that infamous early casualty of war comes in, truth. Because as to how much damage is done and how many missiles made it through, well, your guess is as good as what you're not going to hear told on most of the mainstream media. Much of the knee-jerk press, for example, was saying as of Saturday evening that there were hundreds of missiles and drones launched and not a one of them made it through, thanks to the Iron Dome defenses and the U.S. military being nearby and helping out. In spite of what other sources, including Zero Hedge, say, is not true. Video evidence, says one of their headlines from Sunday, shows several Iranian cruise missiles scored direct hits, particularly on the Israeli military base at Nevatim. The Zero Hedge summary began by noting that both Israel and the U.S. have declared victory in defending against the massive Iranian drone and missile attack overnight, which reportedly saw over 300 projectiles, including drones, sent towards Israel. Ground anti-air systems were very active, including Iron Dome, David Sling, and the Arrow system, intended to thwart long-range missiles. And the skies over Israel were lit up for a number of hours, with explosions ringing out above various cities, especially Jerusalem. And U.S. systems were heavily engaged on behalf of Washington's closest ally in the Mideast. The IDF also subsequently said their Air Force fighter jets downed some 170 drones and 30 cruise missiles. A further statement claimed that, quote, all the drones and cruise missiles were downed outside the country's airspace by the IAF and its allies, including the U.S., U.K., Jordan, France, and others. But there are videos widely circulating on the web that say something very different. They appear to offer proof that at least some of Iran's ballistic missiles did find their way to targets on the ground, contradicting Israel's optimistic narrative of how almost all drones and missiles were intercepted. And the videos show a number of missiles scoring direct hits on at least two key Israeli military bases in the south part of the country, including Nevatim and Ramon Air Base. The question, folks, besides what is true, is what does all of this mean? And what's next? There were reports over the weekend that Israeli war councils were meeting not to decide whether or not to escalate, but how much and how drastically and how soon. And since it's now pretty obvious to most observers that World War III has long been in process, but it's in the process of accelerating, the popular bet as of Monday morning seems to be look for more and bigger war. However, as Zero Hedge notes, whether there'll be a big war or not is still yet to be seen based on Israel's response. The New York Times has reported that Prime Minister Netanyahu backed off early intent to launch an immediate military retaliation after a late-night phone call with the ventriloquist handling the Biden-Fuhrer marionette. And honestly, folks, that was a bit surprising, because it may be the only time that the puppet masters actually had the senile diaper wear not pushing for an escalation in the existing world war towards the nuclear option. Because it certainly looks like, according to a number of analysts, that Iran literally pulled their punches. They struck only military targets. They evidently didn't even kill anyone, especially civilians. They used essentially their low-end armaments, lots of relatively inexpensive drones, and then after exhausting a lot of the Iron Dome and other defenses, defending against just the first wave, and certainly probing their strengths along the way, and ultimately they didn't even use much, if any, of their best stuff. Says the Mideast Eye, also via Zero Hedge, and when it comes to the real issues and lessons learned, it cost Israel more than $1 billion to activate defense systems that intercepted Iran's massive drone and missile attack, according to a number of different sources, including, says this story, a former financial advisor to the Israeli military. Estimated Brigadier General Reem Aminoak, in an interview with Ynet News, the defense tonight was on the order of 4 to 5 billion shekels, or 1 to 1.3 billion bucks, per night, including munitions, manpower, equipment, and fuel costs. And the general highlighted that the staggering price tag for defense stands in stark contrast to the relatively low amount that Iran had to spend to launch its assault. And estimates put that at less than 10% of what it cost Israel to stop the attack. And here, folks, is where the numbers start to get important, if you really want to get a feel for what comes next. Iran launched more than 300 drones and missiles towards Syria on Saturday, says this piece, among a number that are out today, in response to that Israeli attack on its consulate in Syria that killed two senior Revolutionary Guard commanders earlier in the month. Israel said its military forces and allies had successfully intercepted 99% of the missiles, but some of the ballistic missiles did penetrate Israeli defenses and hit the Nevatim air base in southern Israel at minimum. Said the general, if we're talking about ballistic missiles that need to be brought down with an aero system, cruise missiles that need to be brought down with other missiles, and UAVs or unmanned aerial vehicles, which we actually bring down mainly with fighter jets, he said, well, add up the costs. $3.5 million each for an aero missile, $1 million for David Sling, such and such cost for jets, and you end up with something on the order of 4 to 5 billion shekels. And as Zeroheads notes, that would be almost funny. U.S. taxpayer dollars barely covered 60% of that fireworks show. The rest is all debt. And it's the rest of the numbers here, folks, that really bear some examination. Israel, say a number of commentators, is probably the most heavily defended area in the world with multiple layers of air defense systems. And due to the advance warning that they were given, Israel was supported by allies who moved additional anti-missile ships and warplanes into the area, all in preparation. So, if you think about it, this is probably about as good of a best-case scenario as it gets for Western air defenses. And as a result, almost all the drones and slower cruise missiles ended up being shot down, and airplanes with a number of air-to-air missiles took out others before they reached Israel. But remember, in attacks like this, many of those things that were launched were simply drones, decoys, used to distract and exhaust air defenses prior to the ballistic missiles being fired so that more of them might get through. And what matters most, therefore, is the second wave, or maybe the third or later waves, the ballistic missiles themselves. And when it comes to that score, we don't really know what percentage managed to hit. Most sources, though, say that at least 7 missiles probably hit Nevatim Air Base. Some say as many as 15. All of that's backed up by the video footage that I mentioned earlier. Plus, there are reports of strikes on Ramon and even some other air bases, although that might be more doubtful. So, anyway you slice it, a conservative estimate of just what actually got through is probably around 10 or so missiles. We also don't know how many were fired, and Iran hasn't said precisely. We've heard various numbers. The IDF is now claiming 120 were fired, not counting the drones, and that's a figure that's being used by a number of news outlets. So, if you do that simple division, that means about 1 in 12 missiles may have gotten through. And that, remember, is under the best possible circumstances. Multi-layered defenses, fully stocked with anti-air missiles, plenty of warning, complete readiness, multiple allies. And remember, these are probably the oldest Iranian missiles, the stuff that they can afford to waste, that's being shot off first. Because everybody knows you save the best for last, in case the war gets bigger. And we're not even talking about higher-end Chinese and Russian drones and missiles that are probably in the inventory somewhere. So recognize that this is not only a best-case scenario, but it probably would almost never be the case in any other actual real-world battle scenario. Iran needed to save face and appease their populace. Evidently, they did. And they actually did it without a major escalation so far. And if anything, IDF estimates would probably tend to inflate the number of missiles that they intercepted. So when you step back and say, what did this demonstrate? It looks like about the best case scenario is only a 90% or so kill rate of incoming ballistic missiles. And as they use the better and better stuff and exhaust the defenses on the other hand, you can expect that number to go down. Meanwhile, though, even this best-case defense against Iran's second stringers to boot is costing $1 billion a night. And that leads to the real question. Are they really stupid enough to ask, what do things start to look like if they really do manage to get this war to spread? Oh, and by the way, one clue just might be paper precious metals prices. Remember, even though there were expectations that both would go through the roof following an apparent escalation in World War III, we know that there are a couple of countervailing factors on that score. One, of course, is the manipulation itself. Maybe it's just the paper mongers trying to convince the world that gold and silver markets believe the war isn't going to escalate. At least not too much. But whatever the case, gold is up about $25 as I do the recording after having gapped above $2,400 and then being taken back down prior to the weekend's retaliation. It's trading right near $2,370 for a paper promise ounce this morning. Meanwhile, paper silver is up fairly big time, about 3% or 83 cents, and trading at about 28 fiat bucks and 70 cents or so to, again, an ounce you can't actually hold in your hand for that price. So with all the World War III news on the headlines over the weekend, it's certainly fair to ask, what else is being ignored or deliberately obscured during all of the hoo-ha? And one obvious example comes from the criminal state of New York, which is out to destroy the man actually elected president, and the Alvin Bragg criminal trial. No, should be the trial of Alvin Bragg himself, but it's not. It's a criminal trial for Donald J. Trump. Allegedly, at least, the trial starts today, Monday, in New York City. We already know the trial is really over. What they're going to do is go through the circus and then make the announcement. And you know what the announcement is, too. Guilty, guilty, guilty. And if they had their way, it would be hanging by the neck until dead. But now, we'll just see if we can't put him in Rikers and let somebody else take care of that for us. Writes Martin Armstrong on places like the Burning Platform, as everyone is aware, Trump will receive nothing remotely resembling a fair trial, and Bragg, along with the criminally evil judge, will find Trump guilty, 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 and they'll cheer when they manage to get him killed by an inmate. They'll probably have removed the cameras from the cells long before, folks. And I feel sorry, says one of the world's foremost computer prognosticators of future events, for those who are blinded by their hatred of Trump. This is simply tearing down the country, and whatever they do to Trump has now opened the doors for rogue Republican prosecutors, when the time comes, to do the same thing to communist socialists masquerading as Democrats. This is, he notes, and I would say very correctly, the start of the American Civil War version 2.0. Ironically, the first one began April 12th, or so we're told, 1861. This one will be instigated April 15th, 2024. 163 years to at least the week, or in 19 waves, he notes, of 8.6 years, which is important to those that look at cycle theory. This week, the nation is entering uncharted territory, and on Monday, a former president will in fact be tried in what used to be called a court of law, but now is just a court of jokes, for the first time in American history. The elected president, as opposed to the puppet masquerading as such, is charged with 34 counts of falsifying of business records to prevent news of his alleged extramarital affair from becoming public. Which means, from here on out, running for president in the once-free United States, if you're not put there by the deep state, has become a serious personal risk. The gloves are off. There is no rule of law, certainly no national dignity, that will remain standing. And before I continue with too much more of Armstrong's piece, I will note that the Gateway Pundit's coverage says far-left criminal judge Marchand on Monday morning rejected Trump's demand that he recuse himself because he's unfit to be a judge anyway, especially when it comes to personal bias and profit motive. Yeah, hardy har. It used to, folks, be called the appearance of impropriety as opposed to the stench that you just plain can't ignore. In particular, his daughter's political work, some, and that would include your host, might say pretty much outright bribery. Because Lauren Marchand, the far-left 34-year-old political operative and daughter of the criminal masquerading as a judge, has a firm called Authentic Campaigns, which has received tens of millions of bucks of bribes, or donations, from Democrats wanting to take down the elected president that they fear they won't be able to prevent from managing to occupy the Oval Office again. Marchand now says, according to CNN, he is denying the motion for recusal. Gee, there's a shocker. Says he won't even bother to consider it again until the appellate court rules. And isn't it funny? Why didn't he just tell us what the appellate court's going to rule? You can rest assured they all know. And here's another tidbit in the joke pile, this time from the Daily Mail. The so-called judge in the hush money trial of the elected president has now sensationally allowed prosecutors to pretty much introduce any evidence they want, including the evidence of an alleged affair with Playboy model Karen McDougal, but not claims that it actually happened while his wife Melania was pregnant with son Barron. Marchand said prosecutors could bring any evidence they wanted, including that Trump's campaign coordinated with the National Enquirer. It's only a crime, folks, when Republicans do that, to suppress the McDougal allegations before the 2016 almost, but not well enough, rigged election. And the ruling kicked off a dramatic start, says the piece, to jury selection. What a joke. In the historic trial, as Marchand wouldn't even say whether Trump would be allowed to miss court next month to attend the graduation of his 18-year-old son, Barron, from high school. Back then to Martin Armstrong, who writes that Bragg, who's called Trump a rich white guy, is even introducing racism to this event, in addition to Bragg being a zealot Democrat. Of course, remember, racism only works in one direction, kind of like a one-way street. Nobody will ever address that issue. But New York is notorious for corruption in its legal system. And lawyers that I know, writes Martin Armstrong, will privately say New York, and everyone is aware of it, practices law differently than any other place in the country. In fact, their reputation for corruption is indeed historic. And here I'll skip over some of the stuff you've probably heard before, folks. But it dates all the way back to the infamous Boss Tweed a century ago. And as Armstrong concludes, it's still all about desperately trying to prevent Trump from becoming president so they can continue the agenda of wiping out farmers for non-existent climate change and starting World War III ASAP, so much for the land of the free and justice for all. Instead, he says, we're witnessing the total destruction of the United States, and they are deliberately trying to divide the country so that it will be impossible for the United States to remain a single nation, especially not one nation under God. And remember, this is only the first of four so-called criminal trials seeking to destroy any remaining integrity at this point, and that's pretty slim, for the 2024 election, which in itself is intended to be yet another crime. All of these trials are sponsored by the Biden-Fuhrer regime because he's their perfect president, absent 40% of the time, and getting three-letter agencies to do whatever bidding they want to on behalf of their deep state masters. They've literally torn the Constitution, he said, to shreds, and those who hate Trump are such fools that they've allowed the rule of law and politics to be altered forever. Again, he notes, why would anyone run for president knowing that the establishment can literally destroy you criminally or any other way they choose? Our computer, he writes, has projected that the United States will simply no longer exist after about 2032, maybe prior to that. As with all major empires, they have fallen by their own hand in what should be called suicide. And that's what we're witnessing here and now. Bragg, says Martin Armstrong, is seeking to imprison Trump with various felony counts of falsifying records to, quote, conceal criminal activity, including attempts to violate state and federal election laws. Are you ready for this? In order to influence the 2016 election. Says Armstrong, our computer correctly forecasted that Trump would win the 2016 election, and three different models projected that win. The fourth was at best an even tie, but what all of these charges and models show is that any claims of manipulation were total nonsense, as if paying money to this prostitute changed the election in any way, shape, or form. On the other hand, folks, hiding things like the Biden laptop in the most recent election arguably is a far more serious crime and, of course, a whole hell of a lot more likely to not only influence an election, but allow a stolen election to be covered up. As you probably know by now, folks, I think it's enlightening and even entertaining to take a look at the leftists that are out there with at least a modicum of integrity and see how they are reacting to the increasing revelations that, yeah, they've been lying to us for a lot longer than most Americans have even begun to yet figure out. And when they figure out that they really do want you dead, too, the wheels start to come off that wagon. And this example, as it turns out, goes all the way back to January. Well, there are an increasing number of real journalists and authors on that list, but one that I find particularly encouraging is renowned constitutional scholar and Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Jonathan Turley, who has nailed it again with a piece entitled Destroying Democracy to Save It. Maine has shown us exactly what the truth is. Pointing to the scumbag from Maine, Shano Bellows, who he notes has long embraced extreme political and historic viewpoints and recently denounced the Electoral College as a, quote, relic of white supremacy, Turley took her to task for transparent idiocy. And that's a paraphrase, folks. He begins the column, you had me at hello. The line from the movie Jerry Maguire came to mind, he said this week, after yet another Democratic Secretary of State, who evidently wasn't even elected herself, folks, just appointed, moved to prevent citizens from voting for former President Donald Trump. And he said she issued a decision, he puts it in quotes, declaring Trump an insurrectionist and therefore ineligible, so she says, to be president. Joining an ignoble list, notes Turley, of Democratic officials in states such as Colorado who claim to safeguard democracy by denying its exercise to millions of Americans. Still in all, he says, the most striking aspect of this poorly crafted decision was not its litany of conclusory findings, but rather, says Professor Turley, Bellows' implausible suggestion that she struggled over the decision. Bellows was a natural choice for the challengers who've been searching for any officials or courts willing to embrace this dangerous theory under the 14th Amendment that they can unilaterally bar candidates that they deem to be rebellious or insurrectionist. Yep, he says, challengers knew they had Bellows at hello. She was one of the first officials, sick, to declare January 6th to be an insurrection prompted by Trump's speech, in spite of the evidence that they don't want you to hear anyway. And previously, he says she had declared that, quote, the January 6th insurrection was an unlawful attempt to overthrow the results of a free and fair election. The insurrectionists failed. Ut democracy prevailed, unquote. And a year after the riot, Bellows was still denouncing the so-called violent insurrection. Of course, says Jonathan Turley, in that 1996 movie, Jerry Maguire, played by Tom Cruise, reminded Dorothy that, quote, we live in a cynical world, a cynical, cynical world. But you, he added, complete me. And in our own cynical politics, he continues, Bellows and Colorado Secretary of State, and I got to put one word in here, folks, the evil Jenna Griswold, among others, he says, have become wildly popular for seeking to complete the effort to defeat Trump by removing him from the ballot. And this cynicism, he says, is captured in statements from pundits who warn that Democrats could no longer rely on the election process, given Trump's soaring popularity. Obviously, folks, democracy is only an excuse for good government when it fits the leftist narrative. One of them, he says, wrote, quote, Democrats may have to act radically to deny Donald Trump the 2024 Republican nomination. We can't rely on Republicans to do it. Trump must be defeated no matter what it takes. Unquote, and that looks like his emphasis there that's added. Even so, says Turley, there are a few Democrat jurists and officials who've refused to participate in this cynical effort to win the election through the courts, or worse. And the problem is, the Democrats know they only need to get Trump off the ballot in a few states to make him constitutionally incapable of becoming president because of that electoral college that they claim to hate so much. So, Trump could be the overwhelming choice of the voters, but still be effectively barred from assuming office. That is, if they don't just come right out and kill him. And let's be honest, folks, can any real observer actually doubt at this point that that's exactly what by any means necessary boils down to? And to achieve this end, he continues, advocates are willing to adopt the style of ballot cleansing powers long associated with authoritarian regimes in countries like Iran, which is why this theory of disqualification remains one of the most dangerous yet to arise in our nation's history. Now, this next paragraph I am going to read verbatim, even though I would have hoped that a constitutional scholar like Jonathan Turley would actually know what form of government we were supposed to have. Quote, the ballot cleansing effort, he said, is only the latest example of what Justice Louis Brandeis identified as the true threat to our, democracy. Not the threat from other countries, but from within. And here he quotes, the greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning, but without understanding, unquote. And here I part with that, too, because there's nothing well-meaning in the attempt to destroy everything that most Americans fought and died for over two centuries at this point. Still, says Turley, some of these advocates exhibit precisely that zealotry of someone who seems to understand little beyond the next election, as opposed to the next generation, unquote. So, Jonathan Turley says again, yep, not for the first time, that the Supreme Court should not only act with finality, but with unanimity in rejecting this pernicious disqualification theory. But these same advocates, he adds, are likely to seek to delay or avoid such review. Gee, there's a shocker for you. Even, he notes, on the Colorado Supreme Court, composed entirely of Democrat-appointed justices, advocates could only eke out a 4-3 ruling with a vehement dissent rejecting the bogus theory. So he says there's a real chance that one or more of the liberal justices would show that same fealty to the Constitution in rejecting the theory, which would undermine the claims of figures like Joe Scarborough that arguments against barring Trump are laughable and should be mocked. And even if the court doesn't rule on the Colorado decision, Colorado may seek to moot the appeal since the ballot will remain unchanged anyway with Trump's name on it. And, of course, he notes, some justices may prefer this cup to pass from their lips because the divisive opinion in Bush v. Gore from 2000 still reverberates to this very day. And he adds, for an intense institutionalist, that's a polite way to put it, like Chief Justice John Roberts, who, your host notes, has been referred to as the eminently blackmailable, too. Could his name end up being on Epstein's list? Maybe that's part of the reason for the delay. Well, there's a tendency to take exit ramps and avoid rulings if these conflicts can be resolved in the lower courts. Kick it back on down and pray it doesn't come back up here and upset our lunch plans. Well, concludes Professor Turley, the court now faces the call of history. After the decision from Maine, the justices had better realize that neither they nor the country can avoid this moment. Indeed, the court, he says, was designed for this moment to stand between rage and reason, between cynicism and constitutionalism. And proponents knew exactly whom to call upon, he concludes, for the right answer. Yet, to their credit, other Democrats from California to Maine didn't say hello, but instead, hell no to this proposal. And now, it's time for the Supreme Court to do the same. May Yahuwah bless you and yours.